Hi, my name is Gloria Gonzalez. I'm the treasurer of the Society of Environmental Journalists. I'm also an editor focusing on environmental, healthcare, and workplace safety issues in the Washington, D.C. area. I'd like to thank you for coming to this session on cap and trade. Obviously, it's very important that we're here in Sacramento discussing this issue, given the efforts and the leadership that California has demonstrated in this area. We're going to focus on the California program to some extent, but we're also going to talk about more broadly how it fits into the broader scheme of things, both on the national and international level. So I just want to do a couple of quick introductions. Bios are on the website, so if you haven't had a chance to look at those, I encourage you to do so. But first, to my immediate left is Erica Morehouse. She's a senior attorney with the Environmental Defense Fund. In a few minutes, she's going to do a quick primer on cap and trade, just to get people up to speed, and then we'll go into a Q&A discussion with the rest of the panel. To Erica's left is Jason Gray, who is a manager of the cap and trade program of the California Air Resources Board, and he's going to give you, you know, the perspective of the regulator working on the program on a daily basis and talk a little bit about what the program has done to date, what have been the challenges, you know, future changes to the program, that sort of thing. To his left is Roger Williams, who is president of Blue Source, an offset project developer. So Roger's going to give you the perspective of someone who actually develops projects for the offset component of the California program and is a participant in the market. And towards the end is Jim Bushnell, who's a professor at the Department of Economics at UC Davis. And he's going to talk about the market dynamics and compare California's program with other approaches to capping emissions and how those work in comparison. I know there's a number of different approaches that other states are pursuing, so he's going to talk a little bit about that as well. But Erica, if you can just take the floor and give us an introduction to cap and trade, that would be great.
Sure. Thanks so much, Gloria, and thanks for having me here. This is Erica with Environmental Defense Fund. So to start out, we're celebrating 10 years of the climate laws in California. So 2006 was when the Global Warming Solutions Act was passed. And just this year, the legislature and the governor updated that law with new targets, more ambitious greenhouse gas reduction targets for 2030. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. So I want to make sure to mention that the cap and trade program is situated among a much larger suite of policies that are all aimed at getting to these goals that is set by the legislation. So 1990s levels of greenhouse gas emissions reductions by 2020, and now 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. So with cap and trade, I want to talk about really five steps very quickly. So the first step with setting a cap for a state is really measuring it. It's very hard to be successful in losing weight or meeting a goal like that if you don't have a scale. So California needed to know how much greenhouse gas emissions reductions were out there. So in 2008, started requiring reporting of greenhouse gas emissions and used that data to set the cap in a really high integrity way that was based on data and real information. So the cap and trade program started operating in 2013. The second important step is setting that cap, so setting the carbon budget for California and for all of the participants that are a part of that program. And that's sort of an overall budget that makes sure that California is not going to exceed the targets that it's set for itself. And the way that that works is that one allowance is created for representing the budget that has been set, the cap that has been set. And emitters who are regulated by that have to turn in one allowance for each ton of carbon pollution that they emit. And so the next step, the third step that's important, is how do you get those allowances to the entities that are regulated in California? And that is done in a few different ways in California. There's some that are given away for free. That mostly happens in the industrial sector, manufacturing, that kind of thing. And there are also those that are auctioned. So the auctions in California have gotten a fair amount of attention recently. That's where both the utilities in California and the California government, as well as Quebec and other the current partner in the program, sell allowances quarterly. And anyone can participate in those if they meet the sort of requirements of registering, et cetera. So it's not just those that are regulated. There are also traders and investors who are participating in that market. But ultimately, it's a way for regulated entities to get allowances. So because those auctions take place, that also gets us to the fourth step, which is what happens to that revenue once it's created through the auction. It's not, raising that revenue isn't really the point of California's program, but since an auction is an important part of the cap and trade program, that is the next step. And so the legislature steps in on that. They have the responsibility for appropriating that on an annual basis. And they've also committed in California to using all of that revenue to further be reinvested to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as well as making a commitment that at least 25% of it will go to help disadvantaged communities in California. And what that means in California are a number of indices that look at pollution burden as well as socioeconomic status. And California has actually far exceeded that minimum requirement. About 50% so far has actually gone to those communities. And just this year, another bill was passed that also creates a separate pot of money that will specifically help low-income communities. So those may be more like rural communities that don't have the same kind of pollution burden but still face some of the economic challenges that may make it difficult to transition to that clean economy. And so this is a whirlwind, but the very final step that I want to talk about is finding partners, which I think is a big focus of this. So this is a global problem. California has always intended and looked for other partners to work with. The Quebec is the linked jurisdiction right now, so that's sort of the closest partnership. The fungible allowances, a linked market in Ontario is very close to joining that. But there are also other kinds of partnerships that range from just sharing best practices to thinking about looking at other instruments like offsets that maybe others can help define as we get there. So there are a range of ways to partner on climate pollution. And one of the big partnerships that was brought out in the Paris Agreement that Governor Brown really led the effort on was something called an Under-2 MOU that brought, I think, over 135 different sub-national jurisdictions, so states, provinces, cities, that all committed to these really ambitious reductions that they were going to sort of lead the way on.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Erica. And before we get into the Q&A, Jason, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the program from your perspective. Obviously, first of all, this is not Michael Gibbs. This is Jason Gray. Michael Gibbs is his alias. No kidding. So Jason was kind enough to sub in for this session. And actually, I think it's great because he is the manager of the Cap and Trade program and can really give some valuable insights as to how the program has worked to date. And let's talk a little bit about what you've seen. You know, what have been some of the challenges? What do you see as some of the successes of the program to date?
Sure. I was going to thank you. This is Jason for the folks on the recording later.
thank you.
I was going to make a bad joke about Michael and I battling it out for this spot, and I got a bruise here, but I actually just ran into a door. So really exciting. I'm also going to just preface that I'm a new father to my second child who is 5 weeks old. So if I say things that don't make sense, I'm going to be that kind of dad that says I blame it on baby brain. So no, I really appreciate the Air Resources Board being invited to talk. And I think Erica gave a really good summary of the program. For the journalists in the room, which I think is most of you, we have put together, I think it's a 4-page document that walks through a lot of the data sources and explanatory elements of our program. I put it up here if anyone wants it. If you've got questions after this, I'm sure any of the panelists and myself included would be happy to talk. Our communications director is actually back here, Stanley Young, for questions as well. And I think some Cal EPA folks are here. But this is a really good source for all the different types of market data and greenhouse gas emissions data we have. So I may repeat a little bit of what Erica said, and I'll try to go pretty quickly because I know there's a lot of questions from the moderator and also from you all. You know, I think that the primary focus of a market program like Cap and Trade, and really of any of our greenhouse gas reduction programs, is it has to be based on really good data. So we take a fundamental first step approach to getting bottom-up data from those entities that we're saying are covered by the program because they emit a certain amount of emissions. So we've had a long-standing greenhouse gas reporting program that is covering all the industrial sectors, the electricity generators, electricity importers, all those who are covered by our program. And they report that data to us. They have to get it third-party verified through auditors that we accredit. We oversee that. And then we use those emissions data that they submit to our program to assess the compliance obligation under cap and trade, and also to help assess the overall performance of our broader suite of measures that Erica mentioned to meeting our longer-term reduction goals. So first, we get the data reported to us. Once that data is in, that's what those entities have to then surrender to meet those emissions. They have to get instruments, allowances, which are the kind of emissions permits that are issued by the state of California, or in our situation also issued by the linked partner Quebec, or a limited number of offset credits that I think Roger will speak to. They have to submit those to us to show that they're matching their reported verified emissions, and they have to submit those to us on a set timeline to ensure that as that cap declines, that they're meeting their emissions and we're getting those surrendered. As Erica mentioned, there are several ways to get those. The auctions, I think, is what a lot of the questions may be on today, are just one of the mechanisms. They're not required to be participating, but those that are participating can acquire those at auction. The auction serves a really important function of setting a transparent price on those emissions. So it's dependent on demand. It cannot be below the regulatorily defined floor price or auction reserve price for those that are more wonky. And that then does raise some proceeds that the state can use to invest in very important investments throughout the state. But the primary function of the auction is really looking at setting that price signal. Emitters then have to surrender those compliance instruments, those allowances, and up to 8% of their emissions can be from offset credits at the deadlines for surrender, which is every November. We've been working on this for a long time, but the program has actually only gone through one full compliance period, meaning we've only had one actual full set of years in which folks have had to submit instruments to cover that entire period. That was 2013 and 2014 emissions, and we got about 99% compliance, meaning 99% of the emissions that were actually higher than that, that were required to be submitted, were submitted on time, which is a pretty good compliance rate. I used to be the manager of the market monitoring part of the cap and trade program. I was recently made the branch chief. The market monitoring folks are making sure that as a market, folks are complying with the rules, there's no fraud. We go after folks, we call, we are hounding people to make sure we understand what they're doing and they're following the rules and that they know when they have to surrender things and comply. So a lot of the information in this package is actually things we repeat to all of our regulated folks, is don't forget, compliance event, here's how instruments are available, achieving really, really high success rates in that compliance. I'm not sure how much further to go into. There's a lot of linkage questions, I think, in the program, but that is a fundamental element as well, is making sure that this is something we can partner on with other jurisdictions, and I think I'll leave it at that for now.
Sounds good. Thank you, Jason. So we're going to get into Q&A with about half hour left in the program, but I did have some questions and topics that I wanted to go over with our panel. I guess the place to start is looking at the California program specifically. How would you describe the activity to date, both in terms of the allowance markets, but also on the offset side, Roger? I know this is your area of expertise, so how would you describe that activity?
Yeah, again, this is Roger Williams with Blue Source.
Hi, this is Roger Williams with Blue Source, and describing the activity in the market to date, again, we are a primary participant in the market as a developer of offset credits, and that's one component of the program that Jason just described. Focusing on that piece, I'll say that we are seeing some real momentum in the market right now. As the program started a few years ago, there was certainly some growing pains that everyone experienced in taking the rules of the program and actually applying it, landowners or site owners that had projects that could reduce greenhouse gas emissions and applying the rule sets accurately to move forward with the project and go through the various steps that need to take place before a credit is actually issued. And so we went through those growing pains over the first few years, and now we're seeing that there is a shorter time period between beginning a project and actually getting the credits issued. And we're also seeing an uptick in participation. My company, we focus a lot on forest carbon credits, and that is the predominant project type in the California Compliance Program. There have been 28 million credits that have been issued to date. That's around 62% of the overall offsets that have been issued in the market so far. And we work with companies that are investing in timber, but are looking at, well, what are the non-timber environmental attributes that they can consider that's going to influence their bottom line to change their practices, which is pretty exciting, thinking about different ways that they can manage their acres as it pertains to putting a price on carbon. And we have seen a real shift within that group in embracing this as something that's relevant, and that I think is one of the goals here in having an influential outcome in environmental stewardship. We also work with conservation organizations like Audubon Society and Nature Conservancy that are viewing offset projects as a means to fund their activities and their ongoing stewardship of acres and putting conservation easements in place, and as a brand of conservation finance, if you will. That's a new tool for them. And so we're really excited about that. And so as we see the rules now, something that we're getting used to working with, and the third-party auditors and verifiers that need to make sure no one's made a mistake in their quantification and calculation of these benefits, along with the registries that take another look and make sure that the verifiers didn't make a mistake, and then the Air Resources Board that takes a last look. There's a lot of points along the way to make sure that a credit that is issued has actually been triple checked, if you will. And we're seeing that becoming an easier process, if you will, with a heck of a lot of rigor behind it. And so that would be my opening comments on what we're experiencing right now as being a practitioner of not just looking at the policy, but how do you implement this component of it.
Jim, do you want to give some thoughts about the allowance side?
So I thought I would just channel responses to a lot the questions that I've received over the last, you know, months and years on the cap and trade program. And I think they fall into two main categories. One is, why is the government not collecting as much revenue as everybody thought they were? Maybe we can circle back to that one. But I think Erica made the point earlier, which is really important, which is that the primary goal of this is not actually to generate revenue. That's a pleasant side effect that tends to draw everyone's attention, both in the policy arena and in, I think, in coverage. But the point was to put a price on carbon emissions and to elicit a bunch of responses from firms and individuals to reduce their carbon emissions in response to this new cost that they're facing. The price has been stable. It's been tremendously stable because we have a price floor in California. One of the side effects of having a price floor is that it's enforced by selling less permits when the price starts to drop, and that influences the revenue side. I think the other question I usually get is, you know, what has the cap and trade done? What are the reductions that have happened? If you were at the session Wednesday, I was reflecting on this, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating that. It's a really difficult question to answer accurately or precisely, and the reason is cap and trade markets do not measure reduction activity. They measure emissions, just like carbon taxes do. Offset markets are a special case where there are specific projects that are being sort of linked to payments, but more or less, cap and trade markets are about a diffuse measurement of your emissions. And as long as your emissions go down, there isn't a precise tracking of why or how they went down. All we're supposed to care about is that the emissions are at or below a certain level. And this has a bunch of implications to it when we think about trying to measure and write the narratives. First of all, that reductions under market-based, like cap and trade and carbon taxes, tend to be more diffuse, smaller sort of increments, with a lot of individuals making smaller efficiency improvements. The diet sort of analogy was brought up earlier, and I've sort of reflecting on this with colleagues, that you tend to see stories about some crazy diet that get a lot of attention, like we can drop a lot of pounds in a week if you eat only bagels or something. Whereas, everybody knows that you're supposed to just sort of work, eat a little less, exercise a little more, and lose a little bit every week. And cap and trade kind of, if it's working, works in that way. But the one implication of that is it's a little harder to see the effects. You have to dig a little deeper to find that company that saw its costs were a little higher and they did some changes in order to do that. It also means that it's a little easier for everybody to try to claim that cap and trade is doing something or is not doing something that they particularly want to see happen, because it's not explicitly measured. And the cap and trade market is existing in the context of a lot of broader secular trends with the economy, with fuel prices, and with a lot of other directed regulations that are doing specific things to specific companies. And so to answer the question of what is cap and trade doing is actually a very complicated statistical exercise that we don't have a lot of data on. We have 2 or 3 years worth. And so anybody who's claiming the cap and trade is doing something specific is taking some aggressive assumptions about exactly what we can definitively say. People get frustrated when I sort of give them a hedgy answer like that, but I think that is sort of the surface of it, is that we know it's providing incentives to people, but it's more difficult to try to definitively say that emissions in this sector have gone up or down because of cap and trade, because there are a lot of other things that are affecting those same sectors.
Great. So let's do a couple of follow-ups. So we talked a little bit about the revenues, the legislation that was recently enacted on that front. What types of programs, environmental programs, are being funded through the use of the auction revenues, and what where are these projects being located?
Up to you.
Go ahead, Jason.
All right. Sure. This is Jason again, not Michael Gibbs. I think that the legislature has set specific goals in terms of the use of the proceeds that are coming from the auctions. It's called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, or the GGRF, for those of you who like acronyms. All the monies that are coming from the use from the auction have to be used to help further the reduction of greenhouse gases. There's a number of areas in legislation that are slated to do that, so that certain proportions go to different types of activities. As Erica mentioned, and as Senator De Leon mentioned upstairs in the plenary, at least 25% of those have to go to benefit disadvantaged communities. And through the budgeting process, the legislature and the governor have set budgets that exceed that percentage. Just a couple examples of where those are going, and there's a link on this document that you can go and see really where actually the specific dollars are going. There's money that's going towards weatherization in disadvantaged communities and other places. There's money that's going towards solar installations or renewable installation on households. There's money going towards inner city rail. There's money going towards rebate programs for cleaner vehicles. This is all, again, done through the legislative and governor's budgeting process. The Air Resources Board has a role in this in terms of helping set up investment plans every 3 years, so directing this to say, here's different places we think that this could go, and that's presented to the legislature for them to act with the administration through the budgeting process. Our website shows where all the different budgets, because budgets are sometimes hard to read through. They're not the easiest documents to find exactly where things are going. We've tried to distill that into some easier tables to use. Some of the money is reappropriated to the Air Resources Board for transit and for vehicle purposes, and it goes to all different types of programs throughout the state, including natural working lands, wetland restoration, things like that. we have a role as well in looking to see if we can actually quantify the reductions from greenhouse gases, or that those projects do reduce greenhouse gases. So I think one of the subtext of the question is, do these actually do that? And I think our perspective and experience is yes, they do. Some of those quantifications are still in development, but they have to be used for that purpose, and they are.
And maybe I could jump in on why I think it's so important that California is spending the money the way it is. I think that was a great summary of what's happening. So the communities that the disadvantaged communities that have been identified are basically first in line to benefit from this. And I think that's hugely important because of the pollution burden and the socioeconomic status means that those communities are really the ones that are hit first and worst by the impacts of climate change. You know, being low income makes you vulnerable to climate change in a number of ways. It's harder to increase your air conditioning if it's really hot outside, just any number of ways. So it's really important that we're investing in those communities first and making sure that the way that we implement our climate policies in California is taking equity into account and creating a values-based system that works for all Californians. And I think that is an ongoing conversation, an ongoing effort in California in how to make sure that that's happening. And so there are great examples. There have been some great articles that really like, put a face on what this looks like. And I think these revenues get the most attention because they are one of the most tangible ways that Californians can see how this program is affecting them, how this program is benefiting them. As Jim said, reducing greenhouse gas emissions is a very slow, sort of incremental and abstract process. But I think last year they actually crushed a dirty car on the steps of the Capitol. And so that's a very visceral, you know, way of seeing what's happening. We're taking this old, dirty, polluting thing, we're crushing it, and we're replacing it with something new and better that can improve our lives.
So let's talk a little bit about the partnerships that California is engaged in. Obviously, California started its program and then eventually linked with Quebec. We'll link very shortly with Ontario. Talk a little bit about how that works when you're linking with a new jurisdiction. What are the challenges associated with that?
Sure. Yeah, we've got a great partnership with Quebec. And
this is Jason.
Sorry, this is Jason, Air Resources Board. We've got a great partnership with Quebec and are forging one with Ontario as well and others, not just on cap and trade, but on other climate areas. And we really pursued the cap and trade program partly because it would facilitate trying to link with other partners. And this was actually one of the mandates in the AB 32, our implementing statute, and that we've tried to balance in terms of actually setting up our different climate programs. It asked us to look at programs and mechanisms that would enable those types of partnerships, one, to leverage programs in California and also to leverage the programs in those other jurisdictions. So we designed Cap and Trade from the very beginning with the anticipation that we could expand this program. That initial discussion after AB 32 was passed really brought in something called the Western Climate Initiative that had a lot of different Canadian partners, other states in the U.S. that were interested in engaging, and even border states in Mexico who were participating to see what we were talking about and engaging in that discussion. Resulting in that, after the Cap and Trade program was passed, Quebec also was moving forward with a regulatory scheme, cap and trade program that could immediately try to link with ours. We went first. California sometimes likes to do that, and adopted our regulation in 2011, working through the technical details of what linkage actually would require. How do you actually learn from some of the programs like the European system or other cap and trade or market programs to learn from some of the things that have happened, the good things and the bad things, design your program to try to mitigate those, and design it so that when your partners come on, you're synced up so your program can function as one. And that, I guess that would go to the challenge of you're working across different jurisdictions with different legal structures, different legislative structures, different governance structures, and you're still trying to come to the same goal and some of the same technical requirements in your regulatory program. The legislature in 2012, as we were working through the design of our regulatory system, and Quebec was working through the design of theirs, added an additional layer that I think has been really helpful. Our governor has to weigh in on specific findings that a potential partners program is sufficiently rigorous and sufficiently aligned so that they can actually partner with us. And I think this has actually been really critical because it increases what we would already do through the very long sometimes and transparent public process of adopting a regulation, adding an additional layer of transparency where we have to recommend to the governor a real rigorous analysis of a potential partners program. The governor, in his or her independent capacity, gets advice from the Attorney General's office and says, yes or no, I agree with staff's proposal, and we're going to move forward on this linkage. We have one example of this, and it was a yes. So we linked with Quebec in 2013, and our program actually started having auctions together in 2014. But those are really looking at market design. How do you ensure that your market participants in both sides have the same operating rules? How do you ensure that the price signal sent through the auctions is the same price, looking at different currencies, different exchange rates? So all those technical details are a challenge, but something we've been able to overcome and surmount and design our programs together. And that's the same discussion going on with Ontario right now in terms of how that their program can sync up. So we have proposed regulatory amendments back in July. The board, we actually had a board hearing yesterday to consider those amendments, not to vote on them, but for our board to consider. And that would include linking with Ontario starting January 1, 2018. So Ontario is continuing to go through the kind of the final touches of their regulation through their process to make sure that it's synced up. We are discussing with them quite frequently. And we will then have to propose to Governor Brown linkage findings to be able to have our board act on that. But we expect to do that later this year and to have board adoption or board vote next year, early next year, for linkage in 2018.
Roger, so quick follow-up on the offset front. As a project developer, are you able to partner or make deals with organizations based in Quebec? How does that work exactly?
Yeah, so we've been able to do that. We've been engaged in a few transactions so far. Quebec, it is a smaller market for us compared to California, but we have engaged with buyers in Quebec that are purchasing offsets that were registered in California as a demonstration of the linkage that Jason was just articulating. And so we're seeing that, and we're excited that a similar thing will probably happen in Ontario as that program is now going through this process of really getting underway. And we're seeing in Ontario that there currently is a short list of project types that they want to bring in first, three of them, reducing emissions from landfill operations, capturing old refrigerants and destroying them, and also capturing emissions from mining operations, methane emissions. And then there are, you know, seven project types after that are also going to be in the second phase. And so for us, we feel like it's a healthy extension of the program, and I think it's an acknowledgement of California's leadership where they are looking at project types and various aspects of how the California program has been designed and intentionally looking at ways to fit well together with it. And so for us, we are always make cautious decisions about when we are engaging and how quickly we're working with site owners ahead of the policy being fully firmed up. But that is, it's certainly positive indications right now as we see, you know, not only in Quebec and Ontario, but in Washington State, we've heard, you know, positive signals from Oregon and other jurisdictions that are looking to hopefully duplicate what California has done. So that's all an optimistic picture for us, and that we're tracking very closely.
Indeed, and let's talk a little bit more about that, because obviously there's some momentum, whether it's specifically for cap and trade or for some other type of reduction mechanism, there is momentum to do that. What are the factors that could propel more jurisdictions, whether they be in the U.S. or Canada or Mexico, to either link with California, Quebec, and Ontario, or to start their own programs?
Yeah, I could lead off for a minute and then pass it
on.
This
is Roger.
This is Roger again. I think there's a couple of related pieces here. One is the really great momentum around the Paris Agreement and having the U.S. and China recently give the green light and moving forward. And of course, that's going to lead to a lot of other countries continuing to sign on to that agreement. Prior to the negotiations in Paris, the Clean Power Plan was announced that I think is viewed as the United States' kind of effort to, well, what are you going to do in the U.S. Around this issue? And so with the momentum around the Paris Agreement, I think there's going to be more of a focal point on the Clean Power Plan, which also then has various components in it for allowing a lot of state flexibility in how they meet the objectives and the reductions that they need to achieve under that program. And so there's kind of a trickle-down effect, if you will, from this policy momentum that we're seeing that I think is going to be quite positive. And then there's some nice blueprints, again, to work from that in the leadership that California has shown. And we're seeing something similar in Canada right now as well, with Trudeau saying, provinces, they really need to get a plan together, or we will then legislate at the federal level in terms of putting a price on carbon. And so you can see the things really heating up, if you will, in a positive way for provinces, not only in Canada, but in U.S., to really make strides and tangible action on this issue, which is certainly welcomed for us and I think for citizens of both countries and the globe. But I'll pass it on to you guys for any more detail on that.
Sure. This is Erica again. To start, 91 countries expressed interest in using markets to meet their NDCs under the Paris Agreement. So that is a big starting place, a big pool of interest that I think we'll be looking at California for the example that California is putting in place. And I think there are lots of, as I mentioned before, there are lots of ways that those kind of partnerships and that kind of learning from experience can happen. So there's the really close linkages that California is engaging with Canadian provinces. But California also has MOUs in place with China and Mexico, for example, where they're sharing information about best practices. So China right now, largest polluter in the world, has 7 pilot programs of cap and trade programs and has announced that next year they're going to be launching a national cap and trade program within China. And they're really going to be focusing on how do they make that program work for China? How do they reduce emissions in China? So linking directly isn't necessarily the right first step for a lot of these programs, but there are a lot of opportunities for countries and even subnationals like California to work together and to potentially ultimately be able to cooperate to trade reductions and find cost-effective ways to meet obligations. And that's really important from an environmental perspective, because if we can do this in a cost-effective way, that helps us increase the ambition that the world is able to achieve. And a lot of countries have kind of variable commitments that they've made based on what other countries are going to do, or based on if we can go further, we will. And so finding these really cost-effective and flexible ways to reduce emissions is important, and California is really leading the way on that, and also providing an example that our economy can flourish at the same time that emissions are being reduced. And so there are a lot of really positive economic indicators that are happening in California that I think it would be great to talk about too.
And I may just, this is Jason at the Air Resources Board. I may just add briefly to that, because I think that was two good summaries from Roger and from Erica. I mean, our governor has entered into MOUs with different jurisdictions to talk about how potential partnerships could exist, whether it's direct linkage like with Ontario and Quebec, which is really, I forgot to mention the name of the bill, SB 1018 for those writing, is the linkage findings, but other types of partnerships. So Erica mentioned the under two MOU that the governor's office has led leading up to Paris now is 135 member jurisdictions, which is pretty significant. The MOUs we have with Mexico and China and ongoing discussions with them. You know, I think really looking to say, what lessons have we learned from other jurisdictions? Can we share some of our experiences? Can we learn some others from these other jurisdictions as well, is really the approach we're taking. Prior to Paris, I think in 2015, we had about 67 different delegations from around the world coming to talk to us about our experiences, not just to the Air Resources Board, but the Energy Commission, to Cal EPA, and different government agencies here in California. This year has been pretty high as well, so I think the Paris Agreement really was looking for different programs that could be proof of concept. So a linked program between California and Quebec provides one of those examples. There are obviously many other examples folks look to, but there has been quite a bit of interest in our programs, not just cap and trade, but low carbon fuel standard, the renewable portfolio standard, some of our activities on natural working lands. So leveraging those experiences together is really, I think, what the plenary was trying to get at earlier today of there's a lot of different things we can learn and share. But from our perspective, the Paris Agreement really has kind of helped focus folks as well on our program for those types of questions.
Great. So we're at the 30-minute mark, which is the mark where we open it up to you guys. SCJ members get priority, and I already see Mark's hand is up, my fellow board members. So, Mark, your hand shot up first. Please identify yourself, sir, and we will repeat your question for the audio.
I'm Mark Schlepstein.
So the question was regarding Louisiana's restoration program and whether California's cap and trade program could be tapped to fund that restoration, or would Louisiana have to join a cap and trade program linked with California, or are there other mechanisms for doing that?
I'll give that a try. This is Jason Gray. From the cap and trade side, the investment of the auction proceeds is really limited to California projects. That's something the legislature has clearly stated, has stated that those funds are going to be used within California. The linkage question would really be looking for a system that was similarly designed for ours to actually be in the market program. So that's kind of those SB 1018 linkage findings. Those are just two avenues, though. I mean, I think that there's questions for some of our other agencies in California in terms of what types of restoration work they've done. Secretary Laird gave a description of a little bit of that upstairs. I'm not familiar enough to know if there's any funding sources there, but at least walking through some of the experiences. On the carbon offset side, I would speak that in the cap and trade program, we don't currently have any wetland restoration carbon offsets. But I do believe there's some movement in that in the voluntary market. Roger may be able to speak more to that, but those are just initial thoughts.
Yeah, and we have seen increased activity on that front. And, you know, it's interesting because it's always a question when you're developing a new project type of where's the demand, especially in the voluntary market, who's going to buy and support that environmental benefit. And we have been seeing a real uptick on that side as well, where there are large household name brands that are hiring sustainability officers that are in charge of their ESG strategy for their company. And as a result, they're looking at, well, what can we do internally, but what sort of projects can we support as essentially an offset type? And so we've seen a lot of increased momentum on that side of things as well, which I think we're very much welcoming, because a lot of our efforts are driven by, is there demand for the environmental benefit that's created? And I think there's some positive signals there. And so there are some protocols that do exist for wetland restoration. We're seeing similar momentum on grassland projects. And my company is always looking to be a leader in stepping out and actually utilizing these new methodologies and creating these types of benefits if there's demand there for the ultimate product. And so, again, there's positive signals on that front.
Indeed, and I'll just say, this is Gloria. As someone who covered the offset markets for many years, I will say that wetlands projects have the advantage of being considered charismatic projects. So things that corporate buyers are very interested, they want to fund projects that tell a story, that have a good story behind it, versus something that's very technical in nature. So on the voluntary side, that helps with the demand, and it also helps with the pricing. Yes, please identify yourself and state your question very clearly so we can repeat it. So the question is regarding cap and trade versus some of the other approaches, carbon taxes, fee and dividend. Erica, do you want to weigh in on that? And then we'll, sure, I think everybody, I was going to say, I think we'll go down the line on this one because I think everybody has some thoughts.
I'm sure Jim will want to weigh in too. So yes, this is Erica with Environmental Defense Fund. And I think the question is an important one. So some of the benefits of cap and trade that I see are that the cap is a really important part of the cap and trade program. So with a carbon tax, one thing you get is assurance and certainty about the price on carbon. But with cap and trade, what you're getting is real certainty about the emissions that you're going to reduce. You make sure that you're not going to exceed those emissions. And you can also put some pieces in place that provide some of the elements of a tax, some of that price stability. And California has actually been pretty successful at keeping that price really stable, which is something that's very important for businesses because they need to be able to predict where the price is going to be to make their business decisions. So you can kind of get a hybrid approach with cap and trade and get some of both of those benefits. The other benefit of cap and trade is that flexibility to get the lowest cost emissions reductions within the cap first, and so get that low-hanging fruit first and reduce emissions at the lowest cost possible rather than just at a fixed cost. But I think it's also important for governments that are looking to reduce carbon to think about what their objectives are in meeting those requirements. I think for California, cap and trade, my perspective is that cap and trade is the right way to continue. It's in place. It's successful so far in terms of looking at the economy thriving and the cap reducing emissions. And for California, trying to meet these California has a legal obligation to get to these emissions reductions, and the cap gives them the assurance that they're going to meet that obligation.
Sure. I was going to, I think Erica hit
this
one
of... Jim.
This is Jim. Sorry. Jim Bushnell. One of the key attributes of California that distinguishes it from the other cap and trade markets where, and I think where your question's coming from is there's a broad perception that cap and trade has not worked well for carbon markets, which in Europe, in REGI, and, well, Australia sort of just gave up. And I think that perception is driven by the volatility in the permit prices and the fact that they're near zero or have been for quite some time. And so the single best decision California made when they designed this regulation was to put a non-trivial floor on the permit prices. And that does make it functionally a lot like a tax right now. The price is just sort of, it rises at 5% real per year. And so to that extent, I think there is the opportunity to get the best of both worlds. And I agree with that comment that we went through all of this design and allocation discussions that, you know, that to go through that all again just for another mechanism is a lot more complicated than just if we think there's a good number, we can just raise the floor to that number, lower the ceiling to right above that number, and we've got more or less the same kind of price certainty that you would get with a tax. I think the other thing that that needs to be recognized is that the sustainability of our price floor depends upon the sustainability of the cap and trade program, which is in itself there's some, you know, speculation about right now. So our floor that we are enforcing depends upon there being a continual need to buy permits out of the auction. And at some point, if we do not renew this program past 2020, we will have more permits in circulation than probably the market needs, and the price won't be at the floor anymore. And so, you know, back to the earlier discussion about linking with other jurisdictions, I've been wondering what those jurisdictions are exactly making of the discussions in California right now about the future of our program, and what Ontario thinks of joining a program that may not continue past 2020. And so that highlights one of the challenges to linking is that you are making your climate policy a bit more dependent upon decisions made in other jurisdictions. That comes, you know, that's a potential cost. The benefit is that you're getting a lot of opportunity to reduce carbon globally, or at least outside of your own local jurisdiction, especially if there are lower cost opportunities to be able to do that. So back to the earlier, you know, your fundamental question, I think, is I think it's important to distinguish carbon taxes and cap and trade as one set of market-based flexible compliance instruments, distinguishable from a lot of other mechanisms that are targeting specific solutions that rely upon an ex ante sort of knowledge or assumption that there is a right answer, and we want to focus our resources on making that answer the policy focus. Carbon taxes and cap and trade both have that flexibility. I think there are theoretical and practical reasons why you might like one or the other, but as Erica said, there are ways to design both to give them a flavor of the other at the same time.
Thanks, Jason, from the Air Resources Board. I think that's a great question, and I won't repeat what Erica and Jim said, but I mean, I think part of the calculus that the state of California had to go through was based on the legislative mandates, and AB 32 really set quite a few different things for us to consider, and I think we ended up through this process that folks in the room I know and folks at this table were very involved in, of looking how we could best do that based on current conditions, based on where we wanted to go. And I think some of that's looking at design. So some of your questions relate to market design. So we really took a lot of time to design a system where we had lots of checks and balances and could make sure the manipulation and some of the things that have happened in other markets just won't occur. We'll see that and take appropriate action if it does occur. A system that is flexible, ensuring that we can look at cost effectiveness, ensuring that we can look at ability to potentially link with other partners. And also what a cap-and-trade program, the way we've designed it, also looks at is emissions leakage, something that AB 32 required us to do. So how do we best account for that? And through the cap-and-trade program design on the allocation side, making sure that emissions, you know, we're not just shutting down a business that moves across the state line. We're looking at those impacts, those economic and job impacts, and then ultimately emissions impacts through the design of the program. So I think really from my perspective, having, you know, been part of that regulatory design on the staff side, is looking at those different mandates and how to best design those.
Could you state your name and loudly say your question, please?
My name is Josh Marks, reporter, freelance environmental journalist based in Washington, D.C. I'm not sure you addressed this, but those are two questions.
So, Jason, do you want to go first?
So this is Jason. The question was what regulations that we put in place to effectively not allow manipulation and fraud. Great question. You know, I think we really gleaned a lot of lessons from some of the earlier activities in the EU ETS, the European system. We've put in place rigorous know your customer checks. So essentially any individual who is in our system has to go through a background check. That's even before they're associated with an entity account. So those companies that are actually in the program have to use these individuals who have gone through this background check. The companies themselves then have to do a very rigorous corporate association disclosure and business structure disclosure. So we're really looking at the types of things that the federal government, through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, Commodities Futures Trading Commission, advised us on. These are the things you really need to be looking at. That has caused some controversy with some of the companies because it's a quite substantial amount of information to disclose to the state. But that's one thing, making sure that we've got all the information we need on the individuals that are acting in the system, all the information on the companies they're associated with, in addition to all the emissions data that they're also reporting to us. Another design element is we're all in one system. It's a single closed system. It's not different registries that talk to each other. It's one software design system. And that's part of the challenge with other linked jurisdictions is they also have to be in that same system, so their systems requirements need to be the same. But that ensures that there's no ability for someone to create a fictitious credit and insert it into our system that we wouldn't know about. Everything is serialized. We know everything. We issue everything with our linked partners. Nothing from the outside can come in. We also have holding limits. on individual entities. This is how many allowances can they hold. So no one can corner the market. We have purchase limits for auctions. You can't come in and if you have a lot of money, just come out and buy the auction out. We also have auction rules in terms of the participation beyond just the purchase limit. So all these different design elements have been learned from other programs, perfected, got a lot of advice from federal agencies that we coordinate with if there were to be something, commodities markets. And then I think that coordination with partner jurisdictions and other agencies like FERC and CFTC, because one of the disclosure requirements is we require entities to disclose to us their related sister or parent or subsidiaries that are active in other markets, not just the carbon market. So what are they doing in electricity? What are they doing in natural gas? What are they doing in those financial markets that I think the Enron example is something we learned from, some of the California energy issues we've learned from, to build those disclosures in so we can see those different relationships, report those up to the appropriate agencies if it's not a carbon market, if it's a commodities market, and work with the enforcement and market monitoring teams there as well. So I think forging those relationships, building in hopefully smart design into the program, a lot of rigor, a lot of disclosure, and then the actual operating rules for the auctions and for transactions.
Hey, Jim, do you want to take the second part of that question?
Sure, I can take the first part a little bit too. One of the other things I do is I study the energy industries and competition issues. I advise the electricity market operator here on these types of issues and advise the ARB early on in the design of this. One of the big differences between, say, an electricity market, which is the poster child for vulnerable to market power in California, and the cap and trade market has been that when the cap and trade market here established its design, they put an upper bound on how high the price could go. There's been some debates back and forth about whether that mechanism is robust enough, but it's pretty robust. And the state can stand by that more easily than an electricity market can, because people need their electricity right now. And when the price spikes, they still buy it. In a cap and trade market, there's a lot more flexibility because the demand for the instrument is really something coming from just a government regulation, not a tangible consumption that we need right now. And that allows for a lot more flexibility. So there's all these measures that Jason talked about that are all sort of important in terms of validating. But one additional sort of thing that I think is critical is the fact that there are bounds on the price on the high side and the low side. And so if you want to spend money and effort trying to manipulate this carbon price up or down, there's only so far it can go, and that often makes it not worth the effort. All right, so are there any verifiable? Okay, so it depends on what you want to call verifiable. What we can say is every carbon market that I know of, emissions have been below what they thought they would be, and there's been, which is why the price is so low in all those places. Does the cap and trade market, does that mean the cap and trade market caused reductions? Possibly. But back to my earlier comments, cap and trade markets aren't about measuring actual reductions. So other than the offset regimes, other than the dedication of the revenues coming through it, the primary mechanism is just making sure we don't go above a certain level. We know we've been below that level. And the question is, why? Has it been because of incentives provided by the carbon price? Has it been because of the Great Recession, fuel prices, natural gas prices? All those things play a role. You can do statistical analyses to try to determine that. There have been those things done in the EU, and they have shown that there's been at least some reductions caused by, they think, the market. It's not definitive in the sense that we have to sort of think of these things in the broader context. But going to other types of cap and trade institutions, I think, we can be reasonably confident that they do work. There are issues in terms of there are people that we can't cap because they live in other places or they work in industries that aren't directly subject to the cap. And so there are questions about where the emissions go. But for the capped entities, the mechanism works. And so we know that they're not going beyond their caps. But because all we're doing is measuring the upper bound, we don't track exactly how or why they've done the reductions. We know they have.
Great. So we have about 7 minutes left. We have a hard stop at we have a hard stop at 12:15 because of the plenary. So I just want to make sure I get one or two more questions. Please identify yourself and state your question.
Hi, Tony Barbosa here with the LA Times. I have a
So the question briefly was about the uncertainty related to the California program, legal challenges, weak demand, and the latest auction. And it was directed to Jason and Jim. So Jason, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Thanks. This is Jason. You know, as the regulator of the market, where we don't really comment on different demand questions. I think for the latter part of your question on the auctions, the system was designed so that if there wasn't demand at that specific auctions, those allowances are essentially removed from circulation until demand is back up. So that function is working. I mean, they didn't sell those allowances, and then are withheld from the auction until. For the technical terms, until the auctions, two consecutive auctions settle above the auction reserve price. Once that happens, those will come back. Given some of the different comments we have proposed in the regulatory amendment I mentioned earlier, that if those allowances don't sell after 8 auctions, so after 24 months, 2 years, we would seek to move them to the allowance price containment reserve, which is kind of this upper bound Jim was talking about. That's a proposal that is currently out there for public comment. I think that's what I can say on those ones. Jim may have additional questions or additional responses. On the legal side, again, since we are in active litigation, I used to be one of the lawyers at ARB working on that specific lawsuit. I can't really comment on that. I think Jim alluded to some uncertainty. What I can say is, and I actually don't know the scheduling for the briefings at the appellate court, but it is on appeal. We do believe that the cap and trade program is critical in achieving our 2020 target, and that it will be critical as one of the tools to achieve the 2030 target as well. So we held our first board hearing of 2 board hearings on those amendments I mentioned earlier yesterday. We had a long board hearing with lots of different comments, and now it's staff's role to kind of continue assessing those comments and come back with potential changes. But we held that yesterday and do believe that it's effective and it's very important to achieve our emission reduction goals. So we are moving forward. Related to that, a much larger effort on climate planning in California is looking at a different alternatives through a scoping plan measure. And the first draft of that will be available, I believe, next month. And that'll be looking at a different range of issues, including cap and trade, including different policy mechanisms. That will also include some of the measures Jim was alluding to earlier in terms of other climate programs here in California, like the low carbon fuel standard, renewable portfolio standard. How do those all fit together? But our agency is, it is a critical part of achieving 2020, and we have amendments out there now of how that could help going forward.
This is Jim Bushnell. I'll start by saying that I enthusiastically sort of agree that it's important to have cap and trade as part of the portfolio for the 2030, not just because it's probably by far the most cost efficient way for California to do it, but because the point of all of this is to try to bring in a global community doing more or less coordinated reductions in greenhouse gases, and the more we sort of pick very idiosyncratic, attractive to some California specific context items, it may help on the margins in that sense. But I think it has less external replicability or attractiveness. That said, I think the issues, as I understand it, and I am not a lawyer, so I guess I can comment on it, there is a question about whether a 2/3 vote is required to have cap and trade as a valid mechanism. And as I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an expert on these issues, but this type of question does come up in a lot of jurisdictions. It's an unfortunate sort of element of market-based environmental mechanisms are efficient, but they also generate revenue. You'd think that wouldn't be a problem, but it is a problem because it falls under different regulations and state laws that affect taxation, one of which is California's, series of propositions, starting with Proposition 13. So this question about whether a 2/3 vote is or is not necessary for cap and trade is kind of hanging over the market right now. And I think that is affecting the demand for allowances, because if there were no uncertainty about the future of the program, you could buy allowances right now and get a really good deal because the floor price is going up at a steady rate. We expected people to buy them and just hold them. The fact that there is not that sort of market is part of an indication that probably the market is a little worried that there won't be a use for these allowances post-2020, at least. Back to the original question about, you know, how do we interpret the softness of the market now? Part of it is future expectations, but fundamentally what it means is greenhouse gases just aren't very high. And so I sort of paraphrased the reaction over the summer as, oh no, cap and trade's not working. We don't have enough carbon emissions, which is sort of this perverse kind of way of looking at it, that there isn't a demand for carbon allowances right now because emissions are low. And we would hope that people would be buying them now and using them sort of as a means of leveraging future reductions. That's sort of wrapped up in this future of the program question.
Okay, so we have 1 minute left. So Eric is going to weigh in very briefly. Roger, if you could be brief too, so we can wrap it up, that would be great.
I would just say that Environmental Defense Fund is an intervener in the litigation that you were talking about. I'm a lawyer for EDF and I manage that litigation, so I'd be happy to follow up on that question. I feel confident in the legal arguments that we're bringing forward, which basically are that cap and trade is not a tax, so we don't need a two-thirds vote, and that the Air Resources Board does have the authority to use cap and trade as a tool going forward. So I'd be happy to talk more about that with anyone.
Just real quick, this is Roger. I think market participants do need certainty if they're going to be purchasing these allowances into the future. But there's very interesting data regarding the effect on price, and I think it's been exaggerated to an extent in the press around what the effect of the last couple of auctions were, that it's not a sky is falling when you look at the price. Pricing only went from $12.85 down to $12.30, which is a 4% drop. Today, it's trading above the floor price at $12.90. And so you're not seeing that effect of any indication of the sky is falling in terms of how the market is performing right now. So I think that's a pretty relevant point in this discussion.
Great, great. Well, first of all, I want to thank our panel for this interesting discussion. I know we could keep going. This is a fascinating topic. Unfortunately, we have to move towards the plenary, so please make your way to the ballroom and join me in thanking our panelists.